Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to the Arizona Mirror, brought to you each week by Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Lauren Vicker, your volunteer broadcaster, and this episode, on Thursday, December 6, 2024, will feature articles that appeared in the Arizona Mirror over the past week. Since the program airs only once a week, some of the articles may be a bit dated and breaking stories may be added toward the end. The Arizona Mirror is an independent publication which sources stories from all over the state and the nation. We will focus primarily on stories that impact people in Arizona. In this week's episode, these are some of the stories we'll be reading. After years of funding, Indigenous women still missing and murdered at alarming rates. Budget surplus grows to $660 million after strong income tax collections in October. Raul Grijalva will step down as top Dem on key U.S. House panel on environment. Following abortion rights election victory, lawsuit aims to overturn AZ's 15-week abortion ban. U.S. Education Department pings states, schools, to set policies on cell phone use. And let's get started. Our first story, after years of funding, Indigenous women still missing and murdered at alarming rates, by Gabrielle Wallace of Cronkite News, December 3, 2024. Despite grants and numerous programs to help mitigate the issue, cases of missing or murdered Indigenous women continue at relatively high rates. The extent of the problem is almost certainly underestimated. The National Missing and Unidentified Person System showed a dozen missing Indigenous women from Arizona as of mid-2020. They'd been missing, on average, for 21 years. But the Arizona-based Navajo Nation alone lists 22 missing women. Some of the cases date to the 1970s. Advocates for women and Native American crime victims attribute the chronic undercounts and frustrations with resolving these cases to confusion over jurisdiction and lack of cooperation among law enforcement agencies. Sadly, because a person is Navajo, it is sometimes assumed that Navajo will handle the case. In essence, the buck gets passed, said Eugenia Charles Newton, chair of the Law and Order Committee of the Navajo Nation Council. Indigenous women are 5 times more likely than white women to experience violence from their partners, according to research from the National Congress of American Indians. Arizona has 2 tribal women's coalitions that aid survivors of domestic and sexual violence. The Hopi Tiwa Women's Coalition to End Abuse works with Hopi women. The Southwest Indigenous Women's Coalition works with others. If we could have ended this violence against ourselves, we would have done it a long time ago, said Memory Longchase, the Domestic Violence Response Director of Southwest Indigenous Women's Coalition. Jurisdiction issues occur in cities where tribal members live and on or near reservations. A 2018 report from the Urban Indian Health Institute identified 153 cases of missing or murdered Indigenous women that do not exist in any law enforcement records. The report focused on 71 cities in 29 states, including Phoenix, Tucson, Tempe, and Flagstaff. Abigail Echo Hawk, director of the Urban Indian Health Institute and a member of the Pawnee Nation in Oklahoma, said city police departments often assume that if a tribal member reports a crime, it is the tribe's responsibility to handle the case, even if the woman doesn't live on tribal land. That misconception has caused a, quote, nationwide data crisis that hides the extent of violence involving Indigenous women and girls, according to the report. It also causes investigative delays or leads to cases slipping through the cracks entirely. And that, advocates say, has discouraged people from even reporting such cases out of a common belief that if somebody goes missing, they're probably not going to do anything, Long Chase said. Tucson ranked fourth on the list of cities in Echo Hawk's report. Arizona had the third most cases of missing or murdered indigenous women and girls cases. In Arizona, 10 of the 12 women listed in the National Missing and Unidentified Persons Systems had lived in rural areas, according to an Arizona State University research study. Their ages ranged from 20 to 54. The Department of Justice started the Missing or Murdered Indigenous Persons, MMIP, Regional Outreach Program in mid-2023 to help with jurisdictional issues. Five regional programs are each assigned an assistant U.S. attorney and a program coordinator. The Southwest program encompasses Colorado, New Mexico, Utah, Arizona, and Nevada. The program is intended to streamline communication between tribes and state governments. It is still in its early stages. In 2023, 10,650 missing persons cases were filed for American Indians and Alaska Natives, according to the FBI. By the end of the year, 1,631 remained open. About 40% of those involved women. But advocates say many that Native American women have learned through hard experience that abusers rarely face prosecution, so some don't ask authorities for help. If you know five people that have been raped and reported it and nothing happened, how likely are you to report, Long Chase said. Jurisdiction issues can be complicated in Indian country. Policing and prosecution is split between tribes, counties, and the state and federal governments. The responsible entity in many cases is unclear. Nobody has been willing to take up the cause to say all law enforcement, regardless of where they reside, are responsible for the public safety of everybody in their communities, and that absolutely includes the First Peoples of this land, Echo Hawk said. Charles Newton said she was a victim of both violence and a lack of follow-up by authorities. When she was 17, her abuser took her to a shack for about a week. She didn't know where she was, though she knew the abuser. Because I didn't know where I was being kept, where the shed was located, they could never identify the jurisdiction, she said. And the man who I knew, I said his name, they never prosecuted him. Native women and men both experience high rates of victimization, with 84% of women and 82% of men reporting they had experienced violence at some point, according to DOJ data. More than half of Native women have experienced sexual violence, according to the National Institute of Justice, far higher than the overall rate of 1 in 6. Native women are twice as likely to experience sexual assault compared to other races, according to the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network. A House Appropriations Subcommittee held a hearing on November 20th on what it called the crisis of missing or murdered Indigenous women. Five witnesses, all advocates for missing and murdered Indigenous women, each told the panel they knew at least one missing person. Each also had been a victim of violence. This is obviously a vitally important issue to all of us, the subcommittee chairman, Representative Mike Simpson, a Republican from Idaho, said. It brings up many questions, and only some of them involve funding. Multiple laws and programs have been implemented in recent years to alleviate jurisdiction and communication issues. The witnesses said frustrations persist. The jurisdictional issues have really just become an excuse not to do the job, Charles Newton testified. Congress approved the Not Invisible Act in 2020 and established a joint commission between the DOJ and the Department of the Interior to reduce violent crimes against Native Americans. The act established a cross-jurisdictional advisory committee of tribal leaders, federal officials, and relatives of missing and murdered individuals. Another 2020 measure, known as Savannah's Act, named for Savannah LaFontaine Graywind, a member of the Spirit Lake Nation who was murdered when she was 8 months pregnant, was meant to streamline communication between state, federal, and tribal governments and improve MMIP data collection. The Violence Against Women Act also provided $86 million for the DOJ to help tribal victims and support programs. This is way out of proportion to what happens in other areas, said Representative Tom Cole, a Republican from Oklahoma, chairman of the Appropriations Committee and a member of the Chickasaw Nation. We clearly have a very unique problem. We clearly have a lack of jurisdiction in many cases. We clearly have an enormous resource problem. And that concludes this first story. After years of funding, Indigenous women still missing and murdered at alarming rates. Our second story, budget surplus grows to $660 million after strong income tax collections in October, by Jim Small, December 2, 2024. State tax collections beat forecasts in October, growing more than 25% over the prior year and swelling the budget surplus to $660 million just months before lawmakers return to the Capitol and begin crafting a spending plan for 2026. Through the first 4 months of the 2025 fiscal year, state revenues are $235 million more than projected when lawmakers adopted a budget in June. And that's on top of the $425 million surplus that the state realized when the prior fiscal year closed on June 30th. In a monthly review of state finances, legislative budget analysts noted that October revenues outpaced the forecast by $128 million, led by higher individual income tax collections, which made up $74 million of that. The income tax gains were due largely to increased tax withholdings and buttressed by a 34% drop in refund payments compared to a year ago. Those gains edged out unexpected revenue from corporate income taxes, which hit record levels. The Joint Legislative Budget Committee analysts noted that the state collected the most ever, quote, by a significant margin, beating the forecast by $72 million. And state taxes also beat projections by $12 million, growing by over 5% over a year ago. For the fiscal year to date, sales taxes are up 4% over the same period in 2023. That was due in part to resurgent contracting sales taxes, which rebounded in October to grow by nearly 13% over the prior year. But not all sales tax categories are faring as well. Tax collections from bars and restaurants grew by just 1.8% in October and are up just 1% in the first 4 months of the fiscal year, the worst since the height of the pandemic restrictions in 2020. In October, budget analysts noted that there are significant costs on the horizon that lawmakers must address this year, including $183 million in state spending on school building repair, and another $140 million for state employee health insurance. And then there's the impending end to Proposition 123, which voters passed in 2014, to settle a lawsuit against the state that accused it of failing to follow a different voter-approved measure requiring K-12 funding increases every year to keep pace with inflation. That measure boosted the amount of money given to schools from the state land trust, a portfolio of land given to Arizona by the federal government to benefit schools and other public entities. But it expires in 2025, and lawmakers and Governor Katie Hobbs failed this year to devise a solution to extend those payments. Barring an emergency measure sent to voters in the spring, similar to how Prop 123 was passed originally, that means roughly $300 million a year will have to come out of the state's general operating budget. And that concludes this story. Budget surplus grows to $660 million after strong income tax collections in October. Next up, Raul Grijalva will step down as top Dem on key U.S. House panel on the environment, by Jacob Fischler, December 2, 2024. Raul Grijalva, the top Democrat on the U.S. House Natural Resources Committee, will not seek to remain in that position in the next Congress, he said in a written statement Monday. The announcement from Grijalva, an Arizona progressive who has led Democrats on the committee overseeing environmental, public lands, and tribal issues for a decade, paves the way for California's Jared Huffman to take the ranking member role. Meanwhile, in another major development among Democrats in the House, Representative Jamie Raskin of Maryland said he would challenge Representative Jerry Nadler of New York as ranking member on the powerful House Judiciary Committee. This is where we will wage our frontline defense of the freedoms and rights of the people, the integrity of the Department of Justice and the FBI, and the security of our most precious birthright possessions, the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, the rule of law, and democracy itself, Raskin said in a Dear Colleague letter to lawmakers on Monday. I respectfully and humbly ask for your support for my candidacy. Grijalva to focus on recovery. Grijalva disclosed in April that he had been diagnosed with lung cancer. He returned to Congress last month. His Monday statement noted he would continue to focus on his recovery. After much thought, I have decided that it is the right moment to pass the torch as top Democrat on the House Natural Resources Committee for the 119th Congress, he said. I do not make this decision lightly, as being elected ranking member stands as the honor of my professional career. I will continue to focus on improving my health, strengthening my mobility, and serving my district in what is likely to be a time of unprecedented challenge for our community. Grijalva was re-elected to the House in November. He plans to serve his full term as a rank-and-file member, a spokeswoman said. In a statement, Huffman said that if he is made ranking member, he would ask the House Democratic Caucus to give Grijalva the title of Ranking Member Emeritus in recognition of his distinguished career and the enduring importance of his leadership. Grijalva was first elected to the House in 2002. He became the Natural Resources Committee's ranking Democrat in 2015. Inflation Reduction Act. Grijalva chaired the committee while his party held the majority from 2019 to 2023. The first half of his chairmanship was marked by investigations of the first Trump administration, including a criminal referral of former Interior Secretary David Bernhardt. The second half, which occurred during the first 2 years of the Biden administration, amid unified Democratic control of Washington, saw the passage of the climate-focused Inflation Reduction Act that Democrats passed along party lines. With hundreds of millions available in tax breaks for renewable energy projects, the law represented the largest federal investment in addressing climate change to date. I am so deeply proud of the progress that my colleagues and I have achieved in protecting our nation's rich natural and cultural heritage, advancing justice for communities overburdened by pollution, elevating indigenous voices, and honoring tribal sovereignty, fighting for the decolonization of the U.S. territories, and securing a cleaner, safer climate and energy future for all Americans, Grijalva said on Monday. Avoids race among Dems. Grijalva, who is also a chair emeritus of the Congressional Progressive Caucus after he co-chaired that group from 2009 to 2019, thanked colleagues, tribal nations, and environmental organizations who had supported him in his brief bid to fend off the challenge from Huffman. Huffman, 60, said last month he would seek to unseat Grijalva, 76, a rarity among House Democrats who do not use term limits for committee positions and normally strictly adhere to seniority. Huffman is the top Democrat on the panel's Water, Wildlife, and Fisheries Subcommittee. He is also a member of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. A statement from Huffman Monday was full of praise for the outgoing leader and said he would seek to work closely with him in the period of transition. For the past 12 years, Representative Raul Grijalva has been my friend and ally on the Natural Resources Committee, Huffman wrote. Working alongside him, I've seen his grit, determination, and passion for protecting our nation's treasured natural resources, and his ironclad commitment to lifting up frontline and indigenous communities. He has inspired me and countless others with his passion and the clarity of his values. Future generations will benefit from all that he has fought for and accomplished during his remarkable career, the statement continued. Representative Grijalva leaves big shoes to fill, and I will now dedicate myself to building on his legacy of principled and productive leadership as ranking member of the Natural Resources Committee. Grijalva's statement did not name Huffman. A spokesman for Chairman Bruce Westerman, an Arkansas Republican, did not immediately return a message seeking comment. Raskin and Nadler. Raskin said in his letter that he was announcing his challenge to Nadler, a longtime top member of the panel, with respect and boundless admiration, but also said the upcoming session of Congress would be crucial for the nation's future, and House Judiciary would play a major role. We face an administration that would essentially put the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798 on steroids. They want to turn the Justice Department and FBI into weapons of not only mass immigrant roundup and deportation, but political revenge and prosecution. They would collapse the system of separated powers into an all-powerful monarchical executive and convert America from being a defender of democracy and human rights to being an open collaborator with autocrats and authoritarian oppression, wrote Raskin, a former professor of constitutional law at American University's Washington College of Law and a member of the January 6th Investigative Committee in the 117th Congress. They want us to align with Putin's Russia, Kim Jong-un's North Korea, Xi's China, and Orban's Hungary. In the 119th Congress, the Judiciary Committee will be the headquarters of congressional opposition to authoritarianism and MAGA's campaign to dismantle our constitutional system and the rule of law as we know it. I hope to be at the center of this fight, and as someone who has battled cancer and chemotherapy, I can tell you that I will never, never surrender. Nadler told colleagues last month he would like to continue in his role as ranking member of the committee, Axios reported. And that wraps up this story. Raul Grijalva will step down as top Dem on key U.S. House panel on environment. Next up, U.S. Education Department pings states, schools to set policies on cell phone use, by Shawneen Miranda, December 3, 2024. The U.S. Education Department called on every state, school, and district on Tuesday to adopt policies on cell phone use in schools. The department asks schools to have well-thought-out policies on the matter, but does not dictate exactly what those policies should be. An accompanying resource for schools notes the risk social media can pose to students' mental health. In this digital age, every elementary, middle, and high school should have a clear, consistent, and research-informed policy to guide the use of phones and personal devices in school, U.S. Education Secretary Miguel Cardona said in a written statement. The evidence makes clear there is no one-size-fits-all policy, Cardona added, noting that different school communities have different needs, and the nuances of this issue demand that local voices, parents, educators, and students, inform local decisions around the use of personal devices in school. The department acknowledged the role cell phones can play in keeping parents connected to their kids, especially in emergency situations, while also highlighting the increasing evidence on the harms social media can have on youth mental health, such as sleep deprivation and depression. Increasing state policies. an increasing number of states and school districts have enacted policies either prohibiting or restricting students from using their cell phones in the classrooms. Across the country, schools and districts continue to grapple with how to deal with kids' cell phone use, and more than half of all states have sought to ban or restrict cell phone use in the classrooms. As of early November, at least 8 states have passed statewide policies that either limit or prohibit cell phone use in the classrooms, according to KFF. That includes California, Florida, Indiana, Louisiana, Ohio, South Carolina, and Virginia. A Minnesota law forces schools to adopt a policy on cell phone use by March 2025. A handful of other states' education departments have issued policy recommendations or pilot programs, while lawmakers in several more have introduced statewide legislation regarding cell phone use. The guidance from the U.S. Department of Education coincides with the release of a resource for education officials and local communities on adopting cell phone use policies. In the playbook, Cardona points to U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy's public warning in 2023 on social media's effects on youth mental health. Murthy warns, more research is needed to fully understand the impact of social media. However, the current body of evidence indicates that while social media may have benefits for some children and adolescents, there are ample indicators that social media can also have a profound risk of harm to the mental health and well-being of children and adolescents. This article came from State's Newsroom, but we have an addendum, What's Happening in Arizona, from the Arizona Mirror. The legislature passed a bill earlier this year that would have required districts to create policies limiting personal phone use during school hours, but Governor Katie Hobbs vetoed it, writing in her veto letter that it was an unnecessary mandate for an issue schools are already addressing. Hobbs has said she wants individual school districts to have the final say on phone usage, not a one-size-fits-all law that applies to every school. Arizona Superintendent of Public Instruction Tom Horn, who supported this year's legislation, announced in August he would push for a statewide ban on phones in schools when the legislature reconvenes in January. Several Arizona districts have created their own rules regarding phones. The Apache Junction Unified School District adopted a policy over the summer requiring students to keep phones off and out of sight during school hours. Scottsdale Unified banned phones from kindergarten to eighth grade last year, and Gilbert Public Schools is considering a policy that would ban cell phone use during class time. And that concludes this story. U.S. Education Department pings states, schools to set policies on cell phone use. You're listening to the Arizona Mirror, brought to you each week by Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Lauren Vicker, your volunteer broadcaster. As we begin the second half of our program, we have a new story. Bill to add restrictions to early ballot drop-offs returns for next year, by Jared McDonald Evoy, December 3, 2024. The first bill introduced in the Arizona Senate for next year's legislative session aims to add new restrictions for voters who return early ballots to polling places, including limiting the amount of time they have to do so. The prospects for the legislation are dim, however, given that Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs vetoed an identical proposal earlier this year. Senate Bill 1001 would require that voters drop off their ballots after the Friday before Election Day, provide identification to do so. Maricopa County alone saw over 225,000 early ballots dropped off on Election Day this year. Chandler Republican Senator J.D. Mesnard introduced the legislation, which is a carbon copy of the bill he sponsored last session that Hobbs vetoed. he told the Arizona Mirror that he introduced an identical bill to have a, quote, good starting point, and hopes to negotiate with others to get it passed in some form. I've heard some comments that were not giving me a lot of hope from the governor's office on her willingness to address this issue, Mesnard said, adding that he hopes Hobbs will come to the table to find a version of the bill they can all agree on. A spokesman for Hobbs did not respond to a request for comment. The bill is a reaction to the speed at which Arizona counts its ballots, according to Mesnard. Many, including Mesnard and other local Republicans, have often lamented that Arizona's days-long post-election ballot counting isn't as efficient as Florida, which posts the vast majority of its election results by the end of election night. Arizona, particularly Maricopa County, can take considerably longer to post final results. The primary reason for this is the flood of mail ballots that are dropped off at polling sites on Election Day and the Friday prior. Unlike in Arizona, where voters can drop off their ballots at any polling location, Florida only allows mail voters to drop off their ballots at the county elections office. All those dropped off early ballots still have to undergo signature verification, and in some cases, voters need to be contacted, leading to longer waiting times between results. Florida law also requires early ballots to be counted by 7 p.m. the day before Election Day, and those results must be posted within 30 minutes of polls closing. Arizona has no such laws. Mesnard said that people who were previously not on board with his idea last session have been more keen on the idea after seeing the length of time it took to have official results in a number of Arizona races. Setting aside that it is a really bad look on our competence, it also breeds mistrust, Mesnard said. I'd love to get back to where we can get the vast majority of votes cast on Election Day counted. Every ballot cast at a polling place on Election Day is counted immediately, and those results are reported in the hours immediately following the end of voting. Voting rights advocates say Mesnard's plan would make it harder for people to vote. The push behind it is somewhat misleading and misguided. All voting is local, Action's Arizona State Director Alex Gulotta said to the Mirror. Gulotta placed blame for the delays this year squarely on the shoulders of lawmakers who sent a number of legislative proposals to voters in an attempt to avoid Hobbs' veto pen. If the legislature wants to fix something, first and foremost, they can exercise restraint with the number of things they put on the ballot, Gulotta said, referencing the 11 measures GOP lawmakers sent to the ballot this year. It resulted in a two-sheet ballot, a first for the state since 2006. That two-sheet ballot led to a doubling of work for Maricopa County, which counted over 4 million ballot sheets with election officials working overnight for multiple days in order to get the ballots counted before the mandatory certification deadline. Gulotta also said that Mesnard's proposal would make it harder for people to vote. Those who are of lower socioeconomic status often find themselves voting at the last minute, he said, adding that the additional voter ID requirements is something voters have previously rejected. Is making it harder for people to vote an appropriate expense for politicians and candidates to get a quicker answer on who won the election? Gulotta said, adding that many politicians are elected with ballots that only require signatures which are verified by the county recorders. I think the system works quite well, and it balances the needs of a multitude of different types of voters, and it gives them many opportunities to cast their ballot, he added. Mesnard said it is about having the same standard for all voters, and that voters don't see providing an ID as an obstacle to overcome. He also said he is getting more support for the change, citing Maricopa County Recorder-elect Justin Heap, and new GOP members of the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors. I think there is a lot of interest, including from some folks who said, I don't know, but can't now pretend there is not a problem, Mesnard said. Gulotta suggested that if Republicans want to work on election issues this coming session, they should look to Hobbs' bipartisan election task force, which made a number of recommendations to the legislature, including a law that makes it so that those who move across county lines are deregistered to vote. Why aren't we looking at those things as a way to fix the elections instead of hyperpartisan ways that we know are not going to go anywhere, Gulata said. He also shot back at Mesnard and other lawmakers who have been using Florida as an example for the Grand Canyon state to emulate. I don't think we should be using Florida as a best practice of election administration, Gulata said, citing the controversial election police and intimidation of supporters of an abortion initiative in the state by the governor. And that concludes this story. Bill to add restrictions to early ballot drop-offs returns for next year. Our next story, following abortion rights election victory, lawsuit aims to overturn AZ's 15-week abortion ban, by Gloria Rebecca Gomez, December 3, 2024. After voters last month approved sweeping constitutional protections for abortion in Arizona, two local doctors and Planned Parenthood are suing to void the state's 15-week gestational ban. Last month, more than 60% of Arizonans voted to enshrine abortion rights in the state constitution, including access to the procedure generally up to the date of fetal viability, which is typically around 24 weeks. But finalizing that effort requires the courts to overturn the current abortion ban, which was added to state law in 2022. On Tuesday, abortion advocacy groups, including the Center for Reproductive Rights and the American Civil Liberties Union, kick-started the process, filing a lawsuit on behalf of two OBGYNs and the Arizona branch of Planned Parenthood. The lawsuit, filed in Maricopa Superior Court, demands the courts rule the 15-week ban unconstitutional and unenforceable. Absent relief from the ban, Arizonans will continue to suffer the irreparable deprivation of their fundamental rights and serious, irreparable harm to their physical, psychological, and dignity well-being, reads the brief. Proposition 139, certified along with the rest of the 2024 general election results and officially made part of the Arizona Constitution last week by Governor Katie Hobbs, prohibits the passage or enforcement of any law that infringes on a woman's ability to receive an abortion. In the lawsuit, attorneys pointed out that Prop 139 expressly guarantees access to abortions up to fetal viability, and the 15-week ban should be struck down because it outlaws the procedure before then. The protections voters agreed to place in the Arizona Constitution trump the 2022 law, the plaintiffs argue. There is only one exception included in the amendment that could allow for state laws that restrict abortions in some way, but that exception is narrow and mandates that laws which seek to regulate abortions be based in evidence-based medical care and either improve or maintain a patient's health, and the patient's ability to make their own decisions regarding their reproductive health care must be upheld above all else, the doctors argued. The ban fails both parts of this two-part test, reads the lawsuit. And the text of this lawsuit also appears in this article. The 2022 law also includes civil and criminal penalties for doctors who violate its deadline if a woman isn't in danger of death or has the impairment of a, quote, major bodily function. Over the past 2 years, Arizona abortion providers accused of breaking the law faced a Class 6 felony, which carries with it between 4 months and 2 years in prison and the loss of their medical license or financial penalties handed down by the Arizona Medical Board. The Abortion Rights Amendment, however, strictly forbids punishing doctors or anyone else helping a woman obtain the procedure. Failing to eliminate the 15-week law would effectively keep a threat on the books for doctors across the state and would only negatively impact the care Arizona women receive, care that is now legally a right. the ban forces plaintiffs to choose between turning away patients who need abortion care after 15 weeks and risking prosecution and severe civil and licensing penalties, reads the brief. In addition to causing irreparable physical, psychological, and dignitary harms to their patients, the ban directly undermines plaintiffs' ability to provide pre-viability abortions in accordance with their ethical duties and their commitment to providing essential medical care to their patients. Doctors will be able to provide abortion care without threats. Last week, Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays, the state's top prosecutor and the person responsible for representing its laws in court, said that her office would side with reproductive rights groups in the effort to nullify the 15-week gestational ban. Mays said her office considers it to be unconstitutional in the wake of Prop 139. And on Tuesday, she joined a legal agreement reiterating that view and promising that it won't be enforced while litigation continues. That agreement, which is expected to be filed with the court later today as soon as the case is accepted, will offer doctors a legal shield under which to provide abortion care without fear of prosecution. The doctors involved with the lawsuit celebrated that shield as a win for their patients and women across the state. For 2 years, physicians' hands have been tied when a patient needs to end a pregnancy after 15 weeks, including when they face serious pregnancy complications. Scottsdale OBGYN Dr. Eric Roos said in a written statement, "But today we can once again provide care to people who want to end their pregnancy. We hope the courts will quickly recognize the harms of Arizona's ban and strike it down once and for all." The constitutional amendment voters approved last month made it clear that Arizonans value the right to access safe, compassionate care, including abortion, echoed Dr. Paul Isaacson, the co-owner of Family Planning Associates Medical Group, one of a handful of abortion clinics in the Valley. "Yet the 15-week ban forces us to withhold essential care from patients, even when their health or future is at risk. My patients deserve better. I am hopeful that the courts will honor the will of the people and restore their right to make deeply personal decisions about their own bodies." And that concludes this story. Following abortion rights election victory, lawsuit aims to overturn AZ's 15-week abortion ban. Next, we have a story that we ran out of time and weren't able to read last week. Arizona Office of Tourism Director resigns amid conflict of interest allegations, by Caitlin Sievers, November 22, 2024. Lisa Urias, Governor Katie Hobbs' pick to head the Arizona Office of Tourism, tendered her resignation Friday. Her resignation followed a report that revealed a relative of the head of Urias Communication Agency was hired to help design the state's new logo, and that Urias Communications was awarded a multi-year $250,000 contract from the Arizona Department of Education. Arizona Superintendent of Public Instruction Tom Horn claimed that number was incorrect, posting on the social media site X, formerly Twitter, that the department paid $15,000 for a one-year contract with Urias, and that the department did not have any plans to enter into a longer contract. The Arizona Agenda first reported on Thursday that graphic designer Kevin Kuchutiwa was paid $27,500 to help create the logo alongside an outside graphics design company. Kevin's brother is Jason Kuchutiwa, the CEO of Urias Communications, which Urias owns. The Agenda found that the logo redesign was paid for with federal pandemic funds and cost around $700,000, including for nearly 60 listening sessions held virtually and in person across the state. Urias wrote in her resignation letter that the total went toward the logo, as well as an effort to, quote, refresh Arizona's brand, including the development of a state brand playbook and a new state brand video. Urias was appointed to the job in January 2023 and started helming the agency in March 2023. The agenda also pointed out that Urias Communications was awarded a $250,000 five-year contract with the Arizona Department of Education last year to manage events for the Office of Indian Education. In her letter, Urias adamantly denied that her communications firm profited from her position as tourism director. She claimed that Heart and Soul Agency, which won the bid to lead the rebranding project, chose Kevin Kupichiwa to work on the logo design, although Urias recommended him for the job. After the agenda published its reporting, legislative Republicans ripped into Hobbs for the alleged corruption of the tourism director that she appointed. Katie Hobbs continues to exploit her office, break the law, and take advantage of the people of Arizona. Senator Jake Hoffman, a Republican from Queen Creek, wrote in a post on X Thursday, "This is what it looks like when Democrats are in control of your government." In his post, Hoffman incorrectly claimed that Urias' brother was hired to design the logo. Hoffman is the chairman of the far-right Arizona Freedom Caucus and a vociferous Hobbs critic. He also leads a Senate committee created shortly after Hobbs took office in 2023 that held lengthy and acrimonious approval hearings for her nominees for directors of state agencies. The committee often recommended that the Senate decline to approve her director picks, often because they espoused political beliefs, unrelated to their duties, that Republicans opposed. After Hobbs struggled to get her director nominees confirmed by the Senate, she pulled their nominations and appointed them as executive deputy directors, a new position that she said wouldn't require Senate approval. Urias was one of those 13 directors who would be facing a Senate committee hearing in the new year after a judge agreed with Senate Republicans that Hobbs had broken the law with her circumvention of the Senate approval process. We live in an era of heightened political discord where unsubstantiated allegations can inflict immediate and lasting reputational damage, Urias wrote in her resignation letter. Despite the extensive effort and care devoted to rebranding Arizona and the professional management of the day-to-day operations of the office, it became evident that these false allegations would obstruct my confirmation by the Senate Confirmation Committee. Her last day with the Arizona Office of Tourism will be December 4th. Also on Thursday, State Representative Teresa Martinez, a Republican from Casa Grande, asked Democratic Attorney General Chris Mays and Republican Maricopa County Attorney Rachel Mitchell to investigate what she called, quote, potential conflicts of interest. Simply put, Governor Hobbs already violated the law when she appointed Ms. Urias, and as a consequence, Ms. Urias has avoided the checks and balances that are critical to maintaining the separation of powers and the integrity of state government, Martinez wrote. And that concludes this story. Arizona Office of Tourism Director resigns amid conflict of interest allegations. Our next story, with new leaders, Maricopa County's well-guarded elections may see shakeup. While Republican recorder and supervisors made a national name for themselves protecting elections, a few of the newcomers will push for changes. By Jen Fifield of VoteBeat, December 4, 2024. A new crew of Republican politicians will soon take control of Maricopa County's high-profile elections, a major change for a key swing county that has for years contended with unproven claims of widespread voter fraud. The outgoing Republican officials built national profiles for fiercely defending the county's elections against critics within their party. But the newcomers, also all Republicans, have signaled a different approach, saying they will be looking for ways to improve the system. The incoming recorder, Justin Heap, in particular, has been a consistent critic of the county's elections and is pushing for major changes. Heap, currently a Republican state representative, defeated incumbent recorder Stephen Richer in the primary and went on to win the general election in a race that drew national attention. Heepa said he has doubts about the fairness and security of the county's elections, calling the county's system a, quote, laughingstock, and promised voters he would overhaul things. But he splits control over the county's elections with the 5-member Board of Supervisors, and in interviews with VoteBeat, the incoming board members said they plan a measured approach to any changes. On the Board of Supervisors, Mark Stewart, currently a councilman in Chandler, will replace current chairman Jack Sellers. Incumbents Clint Hickman and Bill Gates both declined to run for another term and will be replaced by U.S. Representative Debbie Lesko and former state senator Kate Brophy McGee. The new term begins January 1. The starkest shift may ultimately be to the county's united front when it comes to messaging and tone. County officials have banded together since the 2020 election to issue swift and uniform responses to false claims and criticism, an approach the officials felt helped voter confidence. Now the new officials themselves will be the ones asking questions and must build trust with each other while responding to distrust from voters. Incoming supervisors also hope to rebuild the county's relationship with the state legislature, which fell apart after the 2020 election when lawmakers sued to get the county's ballots to conduct their own audit, a focus on speeding up elections. As recorder, Heap will control voter registration, voter roll maintenance, and certain aspects of early voting. His team will mail out early ballots and verify voter signatures on returned early ballots. But once the signatures are verified, the supervisors take it from there. The supervisors control in-person voting, seasonal hiring, technology, ballot processing, and ballot counting. Heap didn't respond to multiple requests for an interview for this story, but in a recent radio interview on KTAR, he said he will be weighing changes to staffing, to how the voter rolls are cleaned, and to how mail ballots are tracked and kept secure. The people have clearly spoken, he said in the KTAR interview. They demand change to elections that we haven't had in quite a while, and I'm looking forward to getting into office. Heap also emphasized that he wants to speed up the production of final election results, but he won't have much control over that. He can make changes to how quickly his team verifies mail ballot signatures, but ballot processing and counting is controlled by the supervisors. That said, the majority of the new board said in interviews that they, too, want to find ways to speed up the process. Lesko, Brophy, McGee, and Stewart all said separately that they have begun to try to learn more about how the county's elections currently work in order to see what's working and what isn't. The two supervisors who won re-election, Republican Thomas Galvin and Democrat Stephen Gallardo, said in interviews that they're optimistic about how their new colleagues will oversee the process. Asked about whether they trust the county's elections now, the new members offered varying answers. "I'm going to see what has gone right and what has gone wrong," Lesko said, adding that she believes there's room for changes to make it better, though she wasn't specific. Brophy McGee, on the other hand, said she believes that past elections have been fair. "But it takes too long to get the results," she said, and she believes that lengthy results timeline contributes to public distrust. Stewart said in an interview after his primary election win that the courts have proven there was no widespread fraud in the state's elections. But during the campaign, he criticized Maricopa County for its technical problems during the 2022 election, and he said that he did not believe that election was fair to the voters who had to wait in long lines because of the problems. He said the polarization of party politics is frustrating everybody, and he wants to get back to a place where everyone can communicate with one another. As former state lawmakers, Brophy McGee and Lesko said they believe that they can leverage their existing relationships to improve supervisors' relations with state lawmakers. The first idea they want to collaborate with the legislature about, they said, is speeding up election results. Divvying up election duties. State law divides election duties between the recorder and supervisors, and they have a shared services agreement that outlines their roles in more detail. Supervisors have, for decades, delegated more authority to the recorder's office, but have repeatedly revised the agreement to take back control. Gates said the agreement, at this point, is closely aligned with state statutes. If supervisors change it so it isn't, he said, I think you kind of do it at your peril, unless you have really good reasons for it. The current Board of Supervisors decided to again take control over areas where state law grants them authority, in part because when mistakes occurred, they were held responsible anyway. Hickman said if the new supervisors again delegate duties to the recorder, it's still going to be their butt in the fire. The latest change to the agreement came in October, just before the election, when Richer and the supervisors agreed the recorder will no longer control the Information Technology Division or ballot processing. Hickman said supervisors wanted to exercise direct oversight over the IT office in the wake of a few different problems, including the ballot printing errors in 2022. Heap said in the KTR interview that it was short-sighted for the lame duck board to sign this new agreement. I'm already talking to the incoming board members, and one of the first things we will do is work on a new agreement that makes more sense, he said, though it isn't clear exactly what he would propose changing. Lesko and Stewart confirmed separately that they had spoken to Heap and that they are open to revising the agreement. Lesko said that she talked to county staff and they told her that it's normal for new recorders and supervisors to reopen such agreements. Gallardo and Galvin said they support keeping the current agreement. The days of having the recorder in control of functions beyond those specifically laid out in state law, Galvin said, are a, quote, bygone era. What does Heap want to do? Heap's record in the state legislature over the last 2 years provides hints to his priorities. Heap introduced bills that, for example, would have required recorders to keep additional documentation, tracking each ballot all the way through the system, from the time it is printed to the time it is cast. The bill didn't pass, but as recorder, he could change the way Maricopa County's ballots are tracked. State Senator Cesar Aguilar, a Democrat who served with Heap on the Municipal Oversight and Elections Committee this year, said some of Heap's positions concerned him. This includes when Heap pushed to eliminate early voting and voting by mail, saying that's what his constituents wanted. Heap told KTAR that he recognizes he is not going to have the power to simply end mail-in voting, nor would I do that right off the bat if I did. But he said he wants to make changes to ensure the county is securely handling early ballots. And it looks like that's all the time we're going to have for this story about new leaders and Maricopa County's well-guarded elections, perhaps seeing a shakeup. And with that, it's time to conclude this week's edition of the Arizona Mirror, brought to you each week by SunSounds of Arizona. I'm Lauren Vicker, your volunteer broadcaster. Remember that if you missed any part of this program or want to hear a story again, you can go to our website, sunsounds.org, and click on Demand Podcasts. Stay tuned for more great programming from SunSounds of Arizona. And don't forget, you can take SunSounds with you by getting our new SunSounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones, and you can also hear SunSounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Thanks so much for joining us this week, and we look forward to seeing you again next time.